Good afternoon. So last time we sort of finished up talking about how out of order processors work by looking at a slightly higher level view, thinking about, well, what they're really doing is trying to run operations as the values become available, so we can kind of get a picture of when are they going to run things by drawing this graph in the sort of vertices and edges sense that shows us, oh, we have these nodes that represent operations, and we'll draw arrows from, you know, from their dependencies, the data they need, showing where that data is used. And we call this a data flow graph. And this can give us some idea about sort of how an out-of-order processor is likely to execute things, and sort of gives us the intuition that, oh, if we have independent chains of operations, they'll actually run in parallel. But if they're kind of intertwined, if they have dependencies on each other's data, you know, they won't be able to do that. We also talked a bit about more detail about execution units in the processors. And a common thing that happens is when we have operations like multiply, which we often don't have a great way of doing in one cycle and keeping our clock speed very high, we'll have something that does it in multiple cycles. And we might still want to do a new multiply every cycle, or maybe more than one new multiply every cycle. So we'll have these execution units, these things that do these calculations, be pipelines. So they'll take in a new operation every cycle and have multiple stages for that, so they can have multiple of those operations in flight. And we're going to do this on top of all the work we're doing to actually look for multiple instructions that are ready every cycle and find an execution unit for each one and so on. We also talked a bit about how we deal with getting rid of instructions that we shouldn't have run. And we had kind of two cases where this happens in our out-of-order processor. So you had misprediction. In misprediction, unlike our pipeline processor, an instruction we could have gotten all the way to computing a value and having other instructions use that value. And we also had the case of an exception, where we had the same kind of thing, where we might have an instruction that seg faults, but we might not realize that until after we've run a bunch of instructions after it enough to like compute their value. So how do we make it our processor still work with the same interface we expected from our single cycle processor, where it looks like we're running one instruction at a time? And our solution was this commit stage, that we track sort of all our instructions that we haven't completely finished, and we'd only finish them when all the instructions up to and including that instruction were actually done, and we knew that they didn't have an exception or a misprediction or anything which would make us want to cancel them. And in the process of finishing these instructions, we track sort of what the values of the registers for the completely finished instructions are, and this would let us go back to those values if we had an exception or a branch misprediction and start from wherever we made a mistake and started running instructions that, well, aren't supposed to actually run. Then we move to a different topic, which we'll connect back today to this out-of-order stuff, which is on side channel attacks. So we talked about how, like in the lab last week, we had this timing side channel, where we had this function called check passphrase, which all it supposedly told us was yes or no. But it actually had this kind of extra side way it gave us some information, which was how long it took. And because it compared character by character, we learned, oh, it took different amounts of time based on what the actual passphrase was, and kind of leaked extra information besides that yes or no about it. And we saw that this could happen in other cases too. We have the example of with cryptography, if you're doing big integer arithmetic, if those take variable amounts of time depending on the relative values and sizes of the numbers, well, that will tell people about those number sizes, not just whether, you know, they have a particular ciphertext or not. And we also started looking at one thing in particular we could do with timing information, which was inferring things about cache accesses. So when we do some operation, not only does it sort of take a certain amount of time, but it also uses certain parts of the cache. And we don't think of an output of the operation being, here are the parts of the cache I used, but we can get that information. And how can we get that information? Well, you know, the cache doesn't have a function to tell us, I evicted something from set 17, 20, and 25, but we can check, you know, is the thing that was in set 17 still there? Is the thing that was in set 25 still there? And get the answer to that question of what was evicted, even though there's no sort of intended mechanism for us to do so. We're going to look more about that today. Questions about these things we covered last time? Okay, so it's the time of the year where people ask all sorts of questions about how the course is graded. Am I going to drop an extra quiz? I would have done that much earlier. I don't think it's too late to make those sorts of changes. Will the final exam be curved? Is there any consideration to dropping the total weight of the final exam? As I said, not changing the score distribution. As for curved, so a curve implies that I'm going to rank students and, like, you know, say that some percentile is some score. That's not what I'd do ever. However, at the end of the semester, I'm going to look at our overall scores and look at how they correspond to, you know, I guess, how a typical student who gets, say, a raw score of 90 corresponds to our department grading guidelines, which say, for example, that if I assign an A, that means that demonstrates mastery of all learning objectives. And I've guaranteed in the policies that a 90 is at least an A minus, but I might adjust that if I find out, oh gosh, the way these assignments and quizzes and final worked out, I have these students who have an 88, and really they've demonstrated mastery in everything, based typically if they're in that range, and might make adjustments in that way. Okay, so questions about anonymous feedback stuff? Okay, so let's get back to our examples of looking at inferring cache accesses. And through all the examples I'm going to show, we're going to omit two big important things that are actually big practical considerations. So one is, I'm going to kind of ignore that we're really dealing with virtual addresses, not physical ones. The assumption is that we're going to deal with that by allocating space with known physical addresses, or we're somehow able to guess the physical addresses. So that's not going to be a concern. And this is, you know, not actually that much extra work in many real situations. And also, there's going to be some other code around the code we're talking about. So we're talking about inferring cache accesses, and I'm going to be looking at, like, did this one particular access happen? But you might say, gosh, isn't there all this code around it that could also access the cache, especially if we're talking about a cache that's shared between data and instructions? Like, then all the instructions need to fetch from the cache? Yeah. And we're going to kind of gloss over that, but yes, that's going to be something that makes what we're going to talk about later today more complicated in practice. And we have this example we ended with last time, where I want to determine whether this access here happens. And I know where the pointer points, and I know what the cache looks like, and what I'm doing is I'm loading an array into the cache, so it fills the cache. And this means that if this access happens and uses the cache, it has to evict something from that array. It doesn't have any alternative. And so I'm going to check just the index of the array I know will be evicted and determine whether the access actually happened. Questions on this setup that we had from last time? So how do we determine where this access, like what index we should check? And if we look at our pointer value, assuming it's just a physical address, we can take our cache information. We said it's 2 to the 15 bytes. That was 32,768 bytes. Direct map with 64-byte blocks. So I do my work from earlier in the semester and find out that it has 9 index bits and 6 offset bits. So I know that the index bits are these bits here. Or these bits here, yeah, that I've highlighted. So I need to find somewhere in the array which has the same index bits. And I know the array starts at index 0, offset 0. So if I advance by 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 in the array, I'm changing from index 0, offset 0 to index 1, offset 0. If I advance by 1, I'm changing from index 0 to index 0, offset 0 to index 0, offset 1. So the amount I advance by, you know, if I do multiples of 64, I'm going to advance by one index for each one of those multiples. So I can figure out, oh, if I went to get this index of 110, I advance by 110 times 64. And that gives me this array index here. That's going to be something that's evicted that when we access this point. There's also some other addresses I could use that are part of the same block. Any of them would work. So questions on how I computed this address? Okay. So this is the exercise we ended on last time. And one thing I mentioned last time that's going to come up later, we'll revisit this later, is that I'm determining whether the pointer was accessed. And this seems awfully similar to determining whether mystery is true, but it isn't the same thing. And that's because on an out-of-order processor, we do branch prediction. And we might run the instruction long enough to access the cache in some way. It's not going to change the value of that location, but it might access the cache to read the value or set up a write. And this is going to be, we'll see later, a big opportunity. But for now, it's kind of maybe makes this less interesting than we'd like. So here, just been determining yes or no does an access happens. We can also use this to determine some unknown value. So in this example here, I have a value mystery that I'm using as an array index into some other array. So my question is, let's say I know where the other array is, and let's say when I time my accesses, I find out that the thing that was evicted was an address, was an index 800 in hexadecimal of our testing array. So we have this testing array called array that I filled the cache with, and something got evicted from it by accessing other array, and I'd like to figure out where another array that is, and therefore what the index was. And let's assume we have the same cache as before. So we have a 2 to the 15 byte direct mapped cache. And then we're going to have, again, 6 offset bits and 9 index bits. Since that is going to be, yes, information we're going to need. Who can tell me a good first step towards looking at this? Something I might want to figure out to start solving this problem. Not just about violence, just where should I start? Yeah. Okay, break the address. Which address? So you say it might be useful to know how this address divides into offset and index and offset. Yeah. That's one thing we could start with. So I can do that, and we can find out that this is 4,000. It's going to be something, and then we're going to have a bunch of zeros. 0, and the offset bits are all zeros, and the index bits are going to be these 9 bits here. So the index is 1. Did I do that right? Another set of 4 zeros at the end. Yes, I do. Okay. Which means I have my next slide wrong. That's convenient. So we're going to have index of not 1, but here. So divide it up this way. So I have all zeros as my last bits. And when I align this correctly, I find out I want to count out 9 bits from where the offset is. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So this is my index. So my index is going to be index 0x10. So that's a use. So that's gonna, something that's kind of useful to know. This is where what index other array starts at. So why do we want that information? Anyone have what's that going to be useful for? Or is there some other first step I should have taken instead? So you say, another thing you might want is I might want the index, you know, for the array here. I want to know what index was evicted from. And we'll find that out, and that's going to be index 0001000 or index 0x20. So this is cache index 0x20. That's where we actually end up accessing things. Accessing this value. So we evicted, so our array, so other array 0 is at index 10, and the eviction is at index 0x20. So what can we infer from that? So you're saying, hey, that means that the mystery index, that must also have index 20, because that was evicted, because it has to go, because we know that this access here, should be here, we know that this and this both access the same cache set. So they both use the same index bits. So you know, other array plus mystery gives us an index that is going to be 20, and we started with an index of 10. So what we can infer, therefore, is, well, we just need to figure out other array of what is going to be index 0x20. And the answer to that is, well, since other array starts at index 10 offset 0, if we advance by 64 bytes, we get to index 1,1 offset 0. We advance by another 64 bytes, we get to 1,2. So we're going to advance by 0x10, or 16 times 64 bytes. And that's going to be the first possible value that mystery could have. And I have a slide here where I used the wrong number of zeros. So we will correct this slide live. What do I have here? So we'll just write over all this and write the correct value. So we know that we're looking for index 20, and we know that we started with for 0, which is index, not like that, but like, right, I know how I did this. So we know we started with index, with index, which has a 4 here, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. So we know we started at that index 1, 0. And we want to add something to it that will get us to index 2, 0. So we're going to add some value which has a 1, 0, 0, 0 in those index bits, and we don't know what's in the question marks. It could be anything. And note that the question marks also include our tag. We could, in fact, be going really far into other array and go to the, you know, the next where we wrap around. But we've learned a bunch of bits of mystery. So we know for certain that we have these 9 bits of mystery. And if we were doing this with a larger cache, we might learn more than 9 bits of mystery by doing this. So questions on how I figured out. So we figured out where the cache indices of our, where the eviction happened. We looked at where the array started and said, okay, so the index I used to get into the array, you know, it has to have this format. And we know what the index bits of that index are, of array index are. We don't know the other bits, but we've learned a lot. So questions on this process. The question, in terms of this being useful, would I then have to try all the addresses? So it depends what we're trying to do with this. And we'll have some examples where this is going to be way more information than we're supposed to have already. Yeah. Yes. Yep.
Do you mean index 0x10?
Do I mean index 0x10 for x?
Yeah.
So X is the offset in the array, so it's mystery, I should say. So that it does, in fact, so it just happens to have the same index because that's what makes a total to 0x20 in the index. So I just chose X to do the algebra. That's all I'm doing. It's just the algebra to make it actually sum up to the same index number as our actual interesting found value that in the testing array, the one that we filled the cache with. Okay, other questions? Okay, so one complication I skipped over is, I'm assuming a direct map cache. So if we have, say, a two-way cache, this becomes a little more tricky. So here, I'm going back to our first scenario. I just want to detect if the access happens. And my question is, what array index should I check? And I need to check 2. Why do we need to check 2? Because I have a cache. Well, I don't necessarily need to check 2. But if I don't know what the replacement policy is, I need to check 2. Because there are 2 things in the set, and either of them could have gotten evicted. And we want to detect, regardless of which one was evicted, what set it was. So what indices should I be checking for this case? So what would be a good first thing for me to know for this problem? No volunteer. So where it says a high level thing is that, you know, we want it to be the case that this, you know, evicts from some set, from a set of the cache, and it needs to be the same set these are in. That's the goal. That because it's evicted from the set of the cache, that one of these two values must be the one evicted, because those would be the only things in the set. Why would they be the only things in the set? Because we filled the cache with the, just this array. What would be a good thing for me to know to figure out what these indices are? Yeah?
How many sets are cache?
How many sets or cache has? So, which would be index bits. And so I can tell you that with 64 blocks, we have 6 offset bits. And we have 8 index bits, or 256 sets. Yeah, so that's useful information. Any, so we know how many sets there are and how many index bits there are. So what are we going to do with that? So if we want to know whether these two things are going to map to the same set, we want to compare the index bits. So it would be good to know what the index bits would be of any of these. And, well, we don't know the values for one of them, but we do know one for the indices. So we can't compute those yet, but we do know for pointer. So how do we compute what the index bits are for the pointer? No volunteers, or who haven't gone already. Oh, I guess I'll do, so I'm going to just write out this pointer as binary. So we have a bunch of stuff, and then we have the 1, which I'm going to write out as 4 bits, 0, 0, 1, then the 8, 1, 0, 0, 0, then the other 8. So this is the bottom bits of our pointer. We know we have a 6-bit offset, and the remainder is going to be our index. So the index here is going to be, you know, it's up to 8 bits, but we know all the bits before what I'm showing you are all zeros. So the index is going to be, so the pointer index is 110, also known as 6 in decimal. So we want to figure out, what are two places in the array that have index 6? And the array starts at index 0. And I know if I advance by one block, I get from index 0 to 1. So one of these indices, we can say, is going to be x1. We're going to do 6 times the block size, or 6 times 64. And that's going to get us the beginning of the block. And we could choose all sorts of places in that block. But we want to make sure that we see if either of the two blocks that are in this set are evicted. So this is only the first block. So I could choose other addresses in that block, but, you know, I only need one of them because they're all going to be either in the cache or not in the cache. So how do I get to the other block that would map to the same set? Yeah?
If there's an index 1 or older index 2s.
So, OK, you're saying that if I think of how my value is written out, I have my index bits and my offset, and I have a tag here, and I just want to add one to this tag, is what you're proposing. Right, because we want to keep the index and the offset the same, we just want to change the tag to get to another thing that maps to that same set, and we can absolutely do that. So what are we going to do? We're going to add, well, we're going to add the value which adds one to the tag, which is a one, a bunch of zeros, and we actually know exactly how many zeros. It's a one and six plus eight zeros, also known as 2 to the 6 plus 8, or 2 to the 14. So our index 2 is going to be 6 times 64 plus 2 to the 14. Questions? How I computed that. I'm assuming people are very confused, but not getting questions that suggest that, so. Yes. So the sort of high level idea of what we're doing here is we know this evicts from a particular set, and we can figure out what are the other things that use that same set to determine if it happened or not, if it caused something to be evicted or not. Okay, yes?
So we know the address of the printer, and we're trying to find where it is in the cache.
So the question, in this example, we know the address of the pointer, and we're trying to find where it is in the cache. So in this example, we know the address of pointer, and we're trying to find if it was loaded into the cache and therefore evicted something.
Okay. And so in the previous example, we didn't know the address.
So question, how does this compare to the previous example? So in the previous example, we didn't know the address of our pointer, which is some element of other array, but we knew what was evicted. And we used that to determine here that exactly. Does that answer your question? Follow-ups, other questions? Yeah?
Did you just choose an arbitrary index too? Because if we have like another different tag, we say index number 7.
The question is, are there multiple choices for index 2? So because our cache is two-way, and I've exactly filled the cache, there's only going to be two blocks that meet this criteria of being in the same set, because that's all the set can hold. So there are only two correct indices because it's two ways. Does that answer your question?
What if I add like two to the tag?
So question, I added one to the tag to figure it out. What if I added two? Then we'd go out of bounds of the array. So we did the first one because that's the one that's still going to be in the array. If we keep going, we're going to exceed the size of the cache as far as how far we skipped ahead, and we're going to run out of space in the array. Other questions? Okay, so this pattern has a name that you'll see in the literature called prime and probe. So the prime comes from, we're going to fill the cache, or possibly in some cases part of the cache, with values. Then we're going to do something that uses the cache, and then we're going to do this probe step, where we see how many of those values we filled the cache with actually are still there. And this is kind of a general technique for figuring out what cache accesses happened. There's some other techniques we're not going to talk about. I'm just using prime and probe because it's useful and it's obvious why it's something that is possible and not like a mistake someone made. But it's one technique for figuring out what cache accesses happened. And this was originally coined in attacks on AES encryption. So, in fact, in 2004, we have this paper, Cache Attacks and Countermeasures, the Case of AES, and which I think is what coined it, not 100% sure. But the reason why this was so useful then is that early AES implementations used lookup tables a bunch. And the index they used to access the lookup table depended on the key. And also on the data being encrypted, which is a great combination. And This means that you could vary the data, and it should have a known sort of effect on how that relates to the index being chosen based on what the key is. And so they did a version of this attack, and they have here they have the results of them doing the attack. And in our y-axis, we have sort of the input data. And in the x-axis here, on both of these, we have the cache set number. And there's two versions of this picture. So the version on the left is the raw timing data. The version on the right, they've cleaned up the timing data by taking the average over sort of all sorts of data and subtracting it. So we can just see what's different when we change the data. And they did this over many trials, so they got rid of, you know, random things happening on the machine being measurement error, so we have a clear signal. And we have this bar here that moves as we change our input data. And if we can figure out where the lookup table is, we know exactly, we know the range of possible indices into that lookup table. We don't know all of it because the cache set stores more than one thing in the lookup table. But we know a bunch of it. We can figure out probably where the lookup table starts, so we can figure out a few bits of that, which turns out to give us a few bits of the key. And the scenario they were thinking of here is that this was for disk encryption. So you had a system you could log into, but the disk connected to it was encrypted. So if you wanted to run this attack, you just wrote a file to the disk over and over again, and it would encrypt it for you. And you could be on the same machine and do all these timings. This is not great. So this is a problem, and the sort of modern solution is that for this reason, if you're implementing AES or any other encryption thing, you basically don't use lookup tables. Like, you basically can't do that because it's going to be insecure in many contexts. So questions? This example. So there was a question earlier about, oh, we only inferred a few bytes of the access, of the value. How could we use this to infer more bytes? Well, we could hope that the access has a form like this, where they conveniently put all the interesting information in the set by, in this case, making all the offset bits zero. So in this example, the other array starts at index 0. And we've learned that address 400 is where the access is. That means this evicted array of 40s of 0x400. And this has, if we divide it up, we have 0100000. This has in a this cache, it goes to set 0x10. So we must be in set 0x10, which is going to be have a you know an address of the form zero something and then some unknown tag. So what have we learned about mystery? Well, we've learned that in this case, well, since we multiply by the block size, we know that the lower bits are all zeros because of the times block size. And we don't know what the upper bits are. So we know mystery is going to be either 0x10 or 0x10 plus 2 to the 15th, the 1 in the tag bit and all zeros, or 0x10 plus 2 times 2 to the 15th, etc. So those are all our possible values that we just know it's one of those values, but we've learned all the lower bits because we had this convenient multiply times the block size. So this is a way where if we found this pattern somewhere somehow, we could get sort of all the interesting bits of the value. And we could also like move the value around to get other bits. We can kind of scan our value this way. Okay, so now we have this set up where we can learn information about values using, you know, what gets evicted from the cache when we use them. And we're going to talk about making that useful. But first, we're going to go back to, and to make that useful, we're going to go back to our observation that if mystery is false here, the access to pointer could still happen, and we can detect that. So this is a case where our out-of-order processor is letting us detect something that's supposed to be invisible. Because I told you when we have a branch miss prediction, we undo all the stuff that branch prediction does. But that's not true. We don't undo some of the cache accesses. So we could still learn that the cache access happens because probably we're actually doing the cache access before we possibly figure out, you know, that the branch prediction is wrong and then we go back to skip and all that. So we might, you know, actually access the cache, evict something, and that's just how things work. And if we didn't do that, well, we'd have to kind of make sure we're really sure about any branch prediction before we access memory, and that would kind of defeat the point of branch prediction. Like, the idea of doing all this branch prediction is that we don't need to wait to actually go on. In this case, we could go on to anything that doesn't access memory. If you think of most of your code, that's not very far, especially since the stack would count, right? We can't run any push or pops that are predicted. But this wouldn't be very useful. Another observation is that, you know, I said if it's mispredicted, well, what controls whether it's mispredicted? Is there something I could do to make this more likely to be mispredicted? Any ideas? Yeah. So, yeah, so your observation is if it uses the what previously happened, we could, a table of what previously happened, we could make that table have the right value. So one idea is sort of, you know, run it with it true a bunch of times, run the same code with it true a bunch of times, but a different pointer. Pointer, you know, or maybe run code with a true branch that maps to the same table entry, to same table entry in the branch predictor. Like if we had a table-based branch predictor, you know, there's multiple things mapped to the same entry, we could deliberately take advantage of that to make this prediction wrong more often. So we have various strategies where we can basically train the processor to think this is true, even though it's going to be false, and therefore make it start writing instructions that access the point. So one use of this is, let's say we have code like this. So we do our prime and probe attack, so we make an array, and then we see what's evicted from it. And I have some code which is not supposed to run, but we're going to make it be speculated, that the processor is going to do branch prediction, and it's going to think it has to run it. And this code is going to trigger a seg fault and then use some pointer. And a question I have here is, could this access still happen? And on most out-of-order processors, the answer is yes, because we're going to run both the code that uses the pointer and the code that triggers the seg fault, sort of speculatively. We're not going to run them in order, so we might detect the seg fault only after we actually access the pointer. So I'm talking about triggering segfaults because, well, if we think of what triggers segfault, like this is part of our virtual memory lookup. And there's actually kind of two operations when we're doing our virtual memory lookup. So one thing is we need to translate the physical, the virtual address to a physical address. Another thing is that we need to check if the permissions are okay. Remember we had those readable, writable, user mode accessible bits in the page table? We need to check those. And it turned out that several years ago on Intel processors, these were separate steps that were executed at different times in the out-of-order processor they implemented. Oh, and I have misformatted things here. So what we could do is I have here read. Did I have this right? We could have something that's wrong, and we could read a value right here. But that's just not useful. We could read some memory that's not readable, and the processor would speculatively do that, and then we could access an array based on that value we read. And the processor would actually access the cache. Now, all this stuff would be undone in as far as the register values went, but the cache changes would remain. So we'd be able to detect exactly where in the cache this code accessed, even though we were accessing something that was not readable. And that's because the check for whether it's readable happened out of order, that the processor just did the read and figured out later, before giving us the value to actually use, whether it was supposed to be readable. But it turned out, in the meanwhile, it used the value for something we're not supposed to see, which is what changes in the cache. Like that's kind of just invisible. But it turns out we can observe it. So questions? Yes?
So it's like is the, I guess, the ordering of an out-of-order processor, does it look the same every time you run it? Because can be a case where...
So the question is the order consistent? Yeah. So it varies based on things like how fast the memory and the caches are, what's exactly in the cache. So from a practical point of view, it's probably not that consistent, even though theoretically there's usually nothing random. But you can like twiddle things around enough to make this work some of the time, basically. And that's going to be good enough. And when I say memory marked is not readable, the part of the translation that it turned out Intel did this kind of speculatively was checking whether it was user mode accessible. So you could use this to read kernel memory, where basically you choose an address in the operating system memory, you have this code that doesn't actually run, that tries to access it and then modifies the cache, and it would happen, even though the processor would undo all that stuff because the branch prediction was wrong, and you'd be able to figure out the values in the memory. And this is the sort of assembly code they presented from the paper that did this for the part that is for this part in the if statement. So this is the stuff that gets executed because of a branch misprediction and therefore like doesn't really get executed, but the processor does it enough to modify the cache. And what do? So they do our access that triggers a segfault. But remember, the segfault is not triggered immediately. The processor goes on before it really figures out this is a segfault. Then they multiply that value by 4096 to make sure that it goes to different sets depending on what the value is. That we're going to compute an index into an array that's going to vary depending on the value. And they used 4096 because that made sure it was a different index every time, and also it was large enough to avoid triggering prefetchers, which might add other stuff to the cache that would be a problem. And they had this code here where they shifted the value and then checked if it was zero. And the reason for this is that they figured out experimentally that the processor sometimes would not actually do the read, but would have a speculated value of zero internally. So they just tried the read again until the processor really did it in that case. Or sometimes it just wouldn't work, but that's okay, you can keep trying. And then they did an array access that they would detect later because it evicted something from the cache. So they wouldn't actually use the value of any of these registers because those wouldn't exist. They just use the fact that this instruction modified an array, or not a modified array, this instruction accessed something in an array which evicted something from the cache. They detect what was evicted, and that would tell them what RAX was, and that would tell them what the value in memory they're not supposed to have is. Yeah?
This is incorrect. The operations to check if it's readable or the executable is after the memory access.
The question is, the operation to check if it's readable or is after the memory access? I wouldn't say it's necessary. It wasn't clear. We don't have enough detail on how the Intel processors of this era worked, whether it was always after, but at least was sometimes after the cache access.
So if it was sometimes after, you could access the memory and then this would happen?
Yeah. So question, sometimes after, we could access the memory and this all these other things would happen before it acted on the seg fault. Yeah. Yes?
I guess.
Question, how do I get the actual value given that I only know where in the cache it is? So the code that we have that does this access, this here, AL, if it wasn't a seg fault, would be the actual value that we care about. And that value is going to be encoded, that's EAX, so that's RAX here. So that value makes it into our memory address and therefore is part of where in the cache it is. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In addition to like, recovering back from the like set call, would like referring the cache back to the original state like solve?
So, question: if the processor reverted the cache back to the original state when we detected an exception, would that solve this problem? Yes. But to do that, I guess it would solve this particular problem. But to do that, we would need some way of storing the information about all the cache accesses that happened and undoing them, which I'm sure is an idea people thought about, but I don't know the details about sort of how practical or impractical that is. And there might be other types of side channels besides the cache we'll need to worry about. Other questions, comments? Yeah. So the question is, does it need to speculate all the way to that move before it realizes something is predicted? For this to work, yes. But it in fact does that. It's not that many instructions compared to sort of the hundreds of instructions they like when to speculate. Yeah. So the question is, I have a speculated jump inside of a speculated jump. So I have a jump that's run as a result, that's going to be fetched as a result of a branch prediction that's mispredicted. Their hope is actually that it's not speculated and that the processor will have the value of AL to check whether the zero flag is true correctly. And that will make it more likely that they're actually accessing the right part of the array. Because they found, as I said, experimentally that, it turns out that sometimes the processor will put a zero in the result of a cache read while it's speculatively executing things when it doesn't have the value yet. So they need a way of trying to encourage it not to do that. Does that answer your question? Other questions, comments? So this problem was a famous bug known as Meltdown. And what's the fix? Well, the big fix is that the hardware should do the permissions check when it does the translation, so there's no disagreement. And apparently AMD and ARM processors worked this way at the time, and Intel's didn't. And there's a software fix, which is what people implemented who didn't have the hardware fix available, which is that you have your page tables for user programs not have a mapping at all for any of the OS stuff, and that on an exception, you switch to a different page table. This works, but it has some unfortunate performance problems because we're switching page tables a lot more than we would otherwise. And it especially has problems where we don't have what's called a tag TLB, where the TLB has to be cleared when we switch page tables. So that's Spectre. So in our remaining time, we'll talk about a different piece of code that's kind of interesting here. And this is a pattern for code, but doesn't seem actually that unrealistic. Maybe it's a little contrived, but it happens. And that we're doing access to an array and using that to access another array. And before we access the first array, we make sure it's in bounds. And they, oh, well, that means that we're never going to read out of the bounds of the array, so I don't need to worry. But the problem is that we've learned, how does the processor execute this? Well, it guesses whether this if statement is going to happen or not. And probably the best guess is, yeah, it's going to be less. So it's going to try to do this access, even if x is out of bounds. And when it tries to do that access, you know, if we're lucky enough to have this nice times a big number, the cache index will tell us exactly what was in array 1 at x. But array 1 at x is not in array 1. It's just some memory after array 1. In fact, it's memory wherever we want after array 1. So if we wanted to get a secret value, we could say, okay, if array 1 is, say, 1000, if that's where it is, I can take the difference between this and my secret value. So I can have x equal 103f0003 minus 10000. And then when the processor runs our code from before, it's going to access secret, because that's what's out of bounds of array 1, and it's going to conveniently choose what cache set to evict based on that value. So we're using the same pattern we saw in Meltdown, but rather than relying on the processor not to access something it shouldn't, we're relying on other code that just exists, like in our OS, or some library we're calling to access something that it shouldn't speculatively, and tell us its value. And this never actually happens because, well, we have this if statement to keep it from happening, but we learn that that doesn't actually keep it from happening, it just keeps us from seeing the normal effects of it. So we don't see a register value for y, but we do actually see the cache change as a result of accessing array 2. So even though our x is out of bounds, doesn't stop it from happening enough to prevent the cache from changing. So this will tell us, so this sort of pattern was one of the, brought up by sort of another, the other big famous vulnerability called Spectre. So this is one, the sort of the first pattern they brought up. We have this vulnerability where basically what we can figure out that, okay, you know, I can figure out this value even though this code doesn't execute, because it really does execute speculatively and does enough to change the cache and then figure out how the cache changes. Yeah?
So you're saying that, like, even in the case that x is larger than array 1 size, this would, the value of y would be, I guess, put in the cache before the comparison with x and array
So the question is, even when x is greater than array one size, the value of y will be loaded from the cache? Yes. So this is going to be, this is going to be false, but predicted as true. And we can make it be predicted as true by like by just running this code a bunch of times, and the history is going to say, oh, well, yeah, usually x is less than the array size. And that's what we want, in fact, right? We don't want a processor to say, oh, don't know if it's bigger or smaller. Not going to make a guess. We want it to make a guess, and the guess we want it to make almost all the time is that it's less than the array size. And so since this is false, going to be predicted as true, we will the processor will compute the value of y. It will access the cache to do that. It's going to throw away that value, but we can still figure out what that value, we can still figure out something about that because we'll still figure out the value of the index from where in the cache is modified. And we can choose our x to target any value we want because even though, you know, the code tries to check that the access is in bounds of the array, we know that that is going to be ignored by the branch predictor. The branch predictor is just going to keep going on. And we can choose an index into the array that goes out of the array to wherever we want. We can just choose a location. And then we can look at sort of what part of the cache is modified. So for example, let's say I run the code and I find out that this evicts something in cache set 128. And array of 2 starts at cache set 0. Well, I know it's 128 times 64 bytes, possibly plus the, you know, 1 to the number, you know, where the tag name is, right? So I have just a few possibilities. I can figure out the value. So if it's 128, I know that we have that the original value, if I think of my cache, here I have 892 sets. That's going to be 13 index bits. So I have 6 bits and 13 bits. And I can figure out what those bits are and correlate that to x. So in this example, if the cache set is 128, I know I have that this is going to, that our index, so index 128 is going to be 128 times 64, and I can compare that to, you know, 128 times 64 is the first possible index in the array. The next possible one is 8192 plus 128 times 64, which is because if we sort of wrap around, set the tag bit, you know, increment the tag bit by one, that's what we'll get. And I know that my x is one of the, the index into array 2 is one of these values. So it's either this one or this one, and then I can work backwards to compute what x was. What array 1 of x was. And I just do some division, and I'll find out in this case it's 2 or 254, assuming I did this work correctly earlier. So questions about sort of the high-level view. So what we're doing is we just look at what sets change, and we can figure out what are the possible indices to array 2. And once we figure out those indices, we know what value we could have gotten as an index, and therefore what array 1 of x is, which is actually our secret value, right? That this is secret here. This is the secret value because of how we chose x. Questions? About this pattern. I assume people are still confused, especially since I should have had more things worked out here. Okay. So I'm saying we want code of this pattern, and with it, when we have this pattern, we can use it to, we can set x So array 1 of x is our secret value, and we can read whatever we want based on what cache that's changed. You might say, well, no one does this, right? No one has code like this. Well, you know, this is not, one thing to realize is that, well, we don't have code like this, but we do have code like this commonly, where we use one array access to access another thing. And this doesn't have that convenient making sure all our values are in the index bits, but we learn about some of the upper bits. And we can just adjust where x is, like rather than setting it to the address of secret, we set it just before or just after, and we can get different parts of our secret value. So even if we don't have the times 4096, we can kind of compensate for that by choosing to read different parts of our secret value. So they're kind of shifted over in one direction or the other. And it is actually very common to have code which has this kind of format. So here I have some code which is kind of natural looking where, oh, we have some table that is an argument, you know, which function we use, or maybe like a table of file descriptors. We have a check if it's out of bounds. If it's not out of bounds, we look up in the table and then we do something based on what we looked up in using another table. This pattern actually appears a bunch of times just kind of naturally in code for, say, operating systems like Linux and other OSs. Just there in some system call we can call, and it can let us sort of accidentally, because we can choose an index, so this we're going to have this be mispredicted, and this is going to be, you know, out of bounds and accesses some secret value, secret value, and this here, this is going to evict from cache based on the secret value. So we can use this sort of pattern of code that just appears naturally, taking advantage of the fact that that if statement that's supposed to keep us from going out of bounds won't actually stop the processor from continuing. Some questions about this pattern here. And note that my assumption here is that the reason this is a problem is that this code here would be part of the OS. It would run in kernel mode. So it would have extra privileges. So we couldn't do this read memory normally. But this, just like Meltdown, will let us read memory that we're not supposed to. In this case, it's not that the memory read shouldn't be allowed to happen at all. It's just that we're not supposed to get there because of the branch predictions. But the code that's running this is allowed to read memory from wherever. And there's another case where we have this sort of mix-up. And a common example is scripts in web browsers. So scripts in web browsers, you know, they're supposed to not have access to everything, and they can use the same kind of trick. So we can do the prime and probe attack in JavaScript because JavaScript has arrays and it has timing. So that's enough. We can do it. And we can run some, instead of running a system call, we can run some random browser function that has that same pattern of code. Actually, we can do better than that because we can write our own version of the vulnerable code. So the way most browsers execute JavaScript really fast is they compile the JavaScript down to assembly. And they keep the JavaScript assembly from accessing things that they shouldn't because they have bounds checks in it. But of course, those bounds checks are just checks that can be speculated past by the processor. The processor is going to predict that the bounds checks will pass and keep going. It will undo them, but it will still do all the cache accesses. So this means that we can just write the best version of the vulnerable code in JavaScript, and this is what they did in the original Spectre paper, and use this to actually read, you know, from things, because this is just gets compiled down to assembly. You know, that conveniently is exactly the code we wanted to evict things from the cache so we can see what the out of bounds index that we're accessing here will be. So here we have our, this is sort of the out of bounds index that will access a secret. And this is, evicts from cache based on secret. And you just run this a lot to make sure the compiled version of this code predicts this as, we go in this loop, then you change the index to something out of bounds, and it will just conveniently, access some memory in the browser that you're not supposed to access, maybe for some other web page. Some questions on this, sort of why this works in browser. Yeah. Question, what are the ORs for? It's important that this compile to instructions that use integers, and JavaScript's default type is doubles. So they want to make sure the JavaScript to assembly compiler knows that you can use integers for everything here, which is, this is apparently a relatively common script trick in high-performance JavaScript. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown you, that we can supply our own attack code in this JavaScript scenario because the compiler, the browser conveniently compiles our JavaScript to machine code. But it seems like in the kernel scenario, we don't have that option. But it turns out there's a trick that lets us have that option. And that's because so far I've been talking about mispredicting an if-else branch. But there's some other types of jumps we have in code that are also predicted, where we're calling a function via a pointer or doing a lookup table for a switch. And this first one, you might say, I don't use function pointers that often. Well, if you use polymorphic classes, this is typically how we'd implement them efficiently in assembly. It's by looking up a pointer and jumping to it. And processors want to predict this. So typically, they'll have a table sort of history. So a simple way we could do it is we could have a table with where did this computed jump last go for these bits. And in the original Spectre paper, they looked at particularly how Intel Haswell did it. And Intel Haswell did a strategy like this, except they used not just the bits of the jump they were predicting, but also the last few jumps that ran. It turns out that this strategy is really nice for code that uses subclassing with different method calls, because what you've called recently will tell you what you're going to call next. Like if it's part of like the circle subclass or the square subclass, you'll kind of remember that in this table. But the key thing is that this table uses a hash of the jump address. So we could find other jumps that go to the same part of the table and make the processor predict whatever address we want just by running some jump that happens to have some bits in common with the address, and it will just go there. And so what you could do is you find some kernel function which has one of these jumps, and you carefully write your own jump at a related address and run it a whole bunch of times so the processor will predict, that jump goes to this address that you've written code at. And you put your attack code at that address, and it doesn't really run, but the processor will still try to execute it speculatively long enough to modify the cache. And because it's jumped to by the kernel, it will run in kernel mode. Or if you don't have your own code, you can just point to code that already exists that like does the array accesses. That's not in the function that you're supposed to be able to call. So questions about this idea of attacking are, rather than relying on a mispredicted if else, just rely on a mispredicted, jump to some register value. Okay. So this is sort of, I show you two variants of what's called Spectre, and there's a bunch of other variations, and there's two key things we can change. So there's other things that could be mispredicted that could cause us to do things we're not supposed to do and then leave side effects elsewhere. So other examples that have come up are return addresses or mispredicting values instead of what we're to jump to. Also, we can use side channels other than the cache. So I showed us retrieving values based on how the cache changed, but there turns out there's other things that also change and aren't reset when we do speculative execution. So the instruction cache, I just showed you the data cache, but the instruction cache also changes. And there's some internal data structures used for out-of-order processors that would be examples. Or like, if we have a multi-threaded CPU, things there, or the branch predictor data structure. So there's other ways we might get out the information of what happened when this code was executing speculatively before it was undone. So that's where I'm going to leave off since I'm definitely out of time. So logistics note, next time is listed as final exam review. I will be taking your questions. If you don't have questions, I'll just leave. So please have questions.